Classic serial inspired by Holinshed's Chronicles concludes in an hour from now, and tonight Prince John continues to threaten his brother Richard's authority and makes no secret of the fact he intends to succeed to the English throne on Richard's death. Plantagenet, our classic serial, is at 9 o'clock. Before then, Archive on 4, which this week tells the powerful and sometimes disturbing story of how an East London community responded to racial violence in the 1970s. The archive material in the programme includes some of the language and views of far-right movements and their followers. Alan Dean presents Hate Against Hope.
Sorry, my name is Councillor Abdul Shakur, born 10th of October 1956.
Do you think the Battle of 78 was relevant?
Do I think the Battle of 78 was relevant? The Battle of 78 was very relevant because it was a turning point for the community. It was a point which said that we are here to stay. We're not going to be going back. Those of us that were young men at that age said we're not going to be going back to Bangladesh. We're going to be here. So we need to be proud, and we need to feel that our children feel proud.
This voice recalls a past so recent, but already part of local folklore. His story of the Battle of 1978 evokes the legend of the 1936 Battle of Cable Street, when the East End's Jewish population joined together with other local communities to resist Oswald Mosley's black shirts.
You see, one of the things that we picked up from history, they tried to march through the Jewish community in Cable Street. The Jewish community, supported by ordinary white working class, they said they shall not pass. So we had that big strength behind us, that white working class should help.
Reverend Aloke Bishwash is one of some 60 interviewees recounting tales of three generations of Bengalis in Britain, gathered by the Shadi Nata Trust, meaning freedom, a secular Bangladeshi educational body based in Brick Lane. The Oral History Project is part of a process to explore the living memory of the community in its own words, telling its own history.
Can you tell me, were you ever been a victim of racist attack? Any memory?
Well, it's a number of times, actually. Once I was in school, I was attacked by 5 to 7 girls and 2 boys. I was beaten up very badly.
By girls?
Yeah. In school corridor. Then one of the teachers took me to the hospital, and my father stopped me coming to this school for 2.5 months.
The past can be an unpleasant place to dwell, and these oral histories and the material we have gathered around them give voice to a time that seems to me both so different, yet with resonances that can be heard around these shores. Memories that still offer hope against hate.
I think before I come to this country, it's everybody's dream. London is everybody's dream.
Since April, 3 Asians have been murdered.
I can remember pulling families out under attack just by Bethnal Green Station. They were having their windows smashed. This is 1976, less than, 40 years ago.
It is an affair of the whole East End, Hackney, Dow Hamlet and Newham. It is a struggle for the all people of East End.
They're not paid, or they're parasites. They're just pouncing off of us.
What's in the papers that you've been selling today?
Race. Race, the only basis for nationality. If you're white and British, then you can stay.
We couldn't go to certain parts, definitely not beyond Brick Lane. Bethnal Green Road was the no-go area.
You can see 250 young people, all white. They were marching right to Brick Lane. And we had no other option to shout and say, we will defend Brick Lane.
If I'm not safe, none of my family will be safe, none of my community will be safe. So, I had to fight.
Brick Lane has got its own way of absorbing people, right? And you fall in love with it, right? And that love continues, right? You are part of Brick Lane, right? It's quite difficult to describe Brick Lane, right? It's got amazing power of absorbing you.
Nuruddin Ahmed left his village in Sylhet, then part of East Pakistan, in search of adventure in London's East End in 1969. Manchester-born Reverend Ken Leach got there a decade earlier.
I arrived in London just after the so-called Notting Hill riots. For the first time, I gather, for a very long time, Keep Britain White slogans appeared on the walls in the East End. And people were talking about riots in the East End, although they never happened.
When I came in 69, at the time there was only two Bengali shops there. On those days, and even up to 80s, Brickdale was pretty run down for working class people, people working in the rag trade. It used to be quite a scary place, right? I remember I had some friends living in South West London. They used to be amazed. We live in Brick Lane.
It was a very run down. Cable Street was being demolished, quite a bit of demolition in 1967. And so the question arose, where are the prostitutes going to move? And quite a number moved in the direction of Brick Lane, and sometimes into Brick Lane. Both the prostitutes and the drug traffic moved up in that direction. So that was all part of the Brick Lane scene when I first knew it. I can only remember about two Pakistani restaurants. They were both in Brick Lane, but it was very run down.
I first moved into this little bit of the area in 1962.
Kathy Forrester would share the problems faced by the Bengali community in Brick Lane.
How old was I in 1962? Only 11.
Yeah.
We moved into Chicksand House, coming from a one-bedroom with a large family. No different to a Bengali family or an Irish family or wherever. But we was cramped in a one-bedroom. So my mum ended up getting a four-bedroom. We thought it was fantastic. Brick Lane was a very busy place, wasn't it? Very run down, you know, because now it's nothing like how it was. In our day, it was still a lot of Jewish shops as well. Sweet shops, confectionery, hardware shops. But you don't see none of them today. It's pure restaurants, you know. Everything we had in Brick Lane, you know.
This main artery through Spitalfields, bricked over its green fields by the 16th century. Chaucer recorded local residents pursuing unwelcome Flemish arrivals. Huguenot silk weavers fled the Catholics, whilst the Irish labourers, who had built much of it, including Hawksmoor's Christ Church, faced anti-Catholic riots. And then the Jews came en masse from Tsarist Russia, finding only a slightly more welcoming refuge amongst the crammed and tattered streets. It wasn't to change for over a century. Fixed in poverty and sweated labour, hard, pitiless, but still full of life, as this 1983 portrait of Brick Lane found.
That's Truman's clock. It's been there since 1666. Always dead on. All my trade now comes mostly from Truman's Brewery, which is just next to the shop.
How are you?
What do you want to say? That's what I get in there now, all the bloody muffers. See that one there? You see that one?
He's a great man here. I know that about it. He's a great man.
Old Jock's all right.
Yeah,
until he gets on the mouth.
A lot of empty places. Where we're sitting now was a Jewish-owned DIY shop where people came in to buy paraffin for the paraffin heaters because there was no central heating. Lino to put on the table and the floor. It had been Jewish since the 1920s. There were loads of shops up here that did trimmings for the rag trade.
This factory makes leather, ladies' coat, skirts, trousers. Leather is very expensive thing, so we need a very skilled person at least to have enough experience to make a garment, complete garment.
There's a very interesting description of police officers during the 1880s, 1890s at night, where you could walk around and hear the sewing machines. And you could walk around here in the 1970s and hear the sewing machine. There was virtually no unemployment. The rag trade was going, the restaurant trade was going, but older Bangladeshi men would be working in engineering, they'd work in Robert Huff's paper mills down on the Isle of Dogs. Everybody was working.
Terry Fitzpatrick was a builder by trade and king of the squatters by necessity. leaving Brighton behind in the 1970s to eventually forge close links with the Bangladeshi community. Reverend Ken Leach, then ministering to the long-established white community of neighbouring Hoxton, was becoming intrigued by the patterns of a different history, that of organised anti-alien agitation. From the British Brothers League, who had mounted their soapboxes in the early 1900s, to the black-shirted British Union of Fascists, now just a remnant from their former heyday.
They used to sell their papers a site just off Brick Lane, Kerbala Street, which I gathered later had been used as a selling point for the Mosleyites in the 1930s. And I realised there was a geography as well as a history of organised racism and fascism in the East End.
The Bengali settlement in the East End started in 1605, so it weren't exactly new bugs arriving.
Dan Jones arrived in Cable Street in 1967 as a community worker, becoming active in the local trade union movement. He would later be instrumental in organising the giant mural depicting the clash between fascists and anti-fascists in 1936. Local history remains one of his passions.
Significant numbers came through the 1800s and a lot of people came in the war. A huge number of Bengali sailors, seafarers, were drowned in the war and used to work in the engine rooms as donkey men and boiler men and things in the hot, oily things of the ship's holds, and then dropped off legally or illegally, I don't know, from the 1940s.
The first big influx of Bengali migration took place in 1962 when Britain introduced a voucher system whereby employers could bring workforce from South Asia and former Commonwealth countries.
Ansar Ahmed Ullah, coordinator of Shodinata's oral history project. Living in Luton, he'd visit Brick Lane on shopping expeditions with his family, finally making this his home as a community worker in the 1980s.
This influx is not unique to the Bengali community. A large number of South Asians and blacks who came here to work for the health, the transport system, and in the mills and industries up north, as well as in London. So the Bengalis came with other Asians in the 50s and 60s and made this their home because this had cheap accommodation and access to employment. There were a lot of Pakistanis in this area and Indians and, of course, Jewish businesses. And these streets, they're full of sweatshops or factories. Those single men who first came here started to bring their wives and children to come and join them. So this second influx of Bengali migration to this country, I would say, happened from mid-70s onwards because of the realization of the men that they had been here a long time and this is now their home. So it only makes sense to bring their wives and children to come and join them over here.
I think before I come to this country, it's everybody's dream. London is everybody's dream.
Former Tower Hamlets councillor Akiko Rahman.
People are so good, you know, especially we was the police in this country was so good, you know, if you lost in the street, they'll take you home, they love you. You know, it's like people were so good. They're so kind, everything. And it makes us really dream to come in here, you know. Then suddenly I learned that, yeah, that is a problem because obviously there's a lot of people, you know, they start hating us, you know. You can see from there, even though I can't speak their language on that time, but I can see hated, you know, is going somewhere.
Shoreditch was a very white area, but it had Hackney to the north of it with a large West Indian community, and it had Spitalfields to the south of it with a growing Pakistani community, as it was then. And there was a sense of Shoreditch being an island under threat.
It suddenly started, the whole feeling of the area started changing with actual wives and actual little children and starting filling up in the primary schools and very different situation than this rather bizarre 90% male community. And so it was changing all around us as we were watching.
The term paki bashing was coined in the East End on the Collingwood estate in Bethnal Green, and that would have been 68. 68 was also the year of Enoch Powell's Rivers of Blood speech, which was given on Hitler's birthday. I don't think Powell chose that, but it was. And Hitler's birthday was being celebrated in two pubs in the area, one in Shoreditch near Liverpool Street Station and one in Bethnal Green. So 68 was a bad year.
I don't like it. It's always, there's too many Peggy's around here.
15 years later, Radio 4's portrait of Brick Lane could still fill its microphone with the painful racist language and disdain of the street.
All the girls walk past, they're all dirty old men, aren't they? They start making signs at girls and they only cater for their own kind, didn't they? There's all curry shops down there, there's no sort of shops for the English, really. They leave all their rubbish around, no land in the streets, and you walk down the street and you're always here and flobbing over the place. And
yeah, we might smell sometimes when we sweat, but they stink all the time. And then funny clothes they wear, like they're over India.
Yeah, you know.
Why can't they
dress like us?
They're in our country.
They're adjusted to our lives, so they might adjust to our clothes and the way we live.
We have to live by it day by day. We've got to walk past and
disgusting.
Maybe you smell this shit coming up your nose. No, it's not right.
The London Jami Mosque, heart of the Bengali community in the East End of London. It was built as a Huguenot church for French immigrants, later became a synagogue when the Jews moved into the area, and only 2 years ago, it became a mosque, a pattern of change reflected in the whole of the surrounding area. In recent years, the Jewish signs over the shops have gradually given way to Bengali, and Brick Lane is an area which has traditionally attracted poor immigrants to work in the rag trade.
I came from St Albans in Hertfordshire, which when I grew up as a boy and when I left school wasn't a multiracial town. And coming into London and seeing the London changing before my eyes was an appalling culture shock. And I was young and I was interested in politics and I was determined to try and do something about it.
Martin Webster would soon become a leading figure in the extreme far-right National Front Party, which aimed to sway voters with policies such as the mass repatriation of those they considered un-British.
A sense of belonging to a people, a nation, with a culture, with a history, with a patriotism, were being deliberately eroded by the invasion of alien people who had no interest in our culture, our belief. What appalled me is this conversion into a multiracial nightmare.
The Pakistani army had invaded parts of Bangladesh and, of course, they also invaded our village.
Rajanuddin Jalal would become a central figure in mobilising Bangladeshi youth in Brick Lane not long after arriving in England.
I was witness to incidents of rape and violence by the West Pakistani army. And, of course, it was a great feeling when we became independent. Bangladesh became a nation in its own right. I suppose my parents thought that bringing me over to this country would give me a better chance in life. There would be economic prosperity and opportunities that will come my way, and that's how we came over.
I was involved in all sorts of things with families, taking the whole flotillas of women to say, right, this is London, have a look at where you are, you know, this is... And they had very funny things like the buses, people called, there were the two-stick bus, that was number 11 bus, and there were the two-egg bus, that was number 8. Some were beginning to learn English, some spoke very superb English, wonderful, the Bengali power of oratory, amazing, passionate speeches, very articulate. I want to think of them all as not able to speak a word of English, wasn't mixed.
There were only two of us who were Bengali-speaking that attended the boys' secondary school. We were isolated, partly because we didn't know the language very well, and secondly because the rest of the people did not understand us or they were not interested in us. So it was a very mixed experience.
School, it was tough, but I thought it was normal. It was a working-class school in Stepney Green. It's really rough. Looking back at it now, it's probably one of the roughest places in East London.
Playwright Hussein Ismail.
It was constant violence. It was normal just to be called Paki and that kind of stuff.
By 1973-74, we knew the rules in terms of where you can go and where you cannot go.
Regular fights between Bengalis and non-Bengalis. I think everybody saw it as normal, so we just had to find ways of surviving. Either thinking, okay, you're going to come to school, the mornings are not too bad, it's when you go back home and which route you would take, and feeling very nervous, the school day starting, you know, what's going to happen.
I attended school for a few months only due to racist attack, racially abused, street attack by skinheads and schoolmates. Then I joined evening classes.
The first day I went to school, unfortunately I was the odd one out. The first day I went, they broke my arm. I came in February, it was icy, and I think somebody pushed me deliberately, and I broke my arm first day.
And there would be every other week a big battle in the local park, because there's a rumour there's going to be a big fight and the racists are going to mobilise, so we, you know, the people who are tough enough would organise the opposition, let's say.
Every Bengali who was able to learn driving and pass the driving test made a priority to buy a car. Why? Because this way you are safe to travel, go to work, go to school, go to college, do other things. Otherwise, you would be attacked on the street without any reason.
Rajanuddin Jalal became one of the documentary subjects of the 1979 BBC television series The City, then offering a rare glimpse of a community still little seen or understood.
Jalal, not yet 20, has lived here for 7 years. In that time, his generation has been forced to evaluate again its culture and its role in the community.
I had to work for my survival. When I was 14 or 15, I used to work in the clothing industry myself to earn my living, because my parents had gone back and I had to survive.
I think it's a hard job. It's basically machining all day and doing ladies' embroidery. Conditions are bad. There is no existence of the trade union movement within these little factories in the rag trade. And to me, it is often boring, but can't help it, because there is nothing else I can do. And perhaps given the opportunity to do. I would like to go back to college and study so that I'd be able to do more in the community and for myself as well.
By then, I think we found a network of peers and friends who were supporting each other. And of course, you were subjected to a lot of discrimination and exploitation by many landlords who were not Bengali. And so initially, you would try and survive in harsh conditions. You never had adequate housing. Whether you were a single person or a family, you never had proper housing. And because people did not have the economic strength to buy their own homes, they eventually had to rely on the public sector, local authority housing.
Jalal stays here. He's on the housing list waiting for a flat, but none's come up yet. And he also wants a flat in this area, you know, or over on Commercial Road area.
That's Kathy Forrester, heard earlier in this programme. Here in 1979, she and Jalal await the visit of the all-important housing officer.
Good evening. I'm from the department to see Mr. Uddin. Is he in? It's my identification card. Jalal!
Yeah?
It's for you. It's the housing woman. Come in, okay?
Thank you.
Hello. Good evening. Oh. Okay.
Good evening.
A flat. You take a flat, any flat.
Well, as I'm homeless, you see, I'm staying here temporarily, so I want to get one desperately.
You'll take anything.
Well, I mean, I'd really appreciate a flat round here, because I have also...
I agree, but if we can't fix you up in that area, what would be your next choice?
Well, there are flats empty, you see.
No, we're not concerned with that. I'm just asking you what your choice is. All right.
I'd like to stay in this area or St. Mary's.
OK.
So how long is it going to take?
I can't give you any dates. I'm just here doing a visit. You've only just registered on the list on the 31st of October, right?
Well, the market is I'm homeless. I'm homeless.
We have a lot of people that you're not homeless, you're living here. I'm not arguing about it, I'm here to do a visit, all right?
Yeah, I'm not trying to have an argument with you either.
I can't give you any date when you're going to be housed. I'm not here to give you dates. I'm here to visit and report back to the office.
I was aware that there were formidable obstacles, but there were a lot of grounds for hope as well.
What kind of obstacles did you see that the Bengali community had to surmount?
The problem then was that a lot of the flats that they were offered were in unsafe areas where violence was rife.
I can remember being called out one evening when I was chairman of housing to Branton Wharf Estate, which was an estate that had very few Bengalis on it.
Reg Beer was then chair of the Tower Hamlets Health and Housing Committee.
Going into a house where there was a woman cowering with her children, most of the windows had been bricked in. That's to say, bricks had been put through the windows and the debris was on the inside of the house. So you can imagine a woman like that, yeah, she did want to get out of Branton Wharf. I just said to the housing officer on the spot, you know, she can't stay here tonight. Find her somewhere in Spitalfields, yeah, which they did, and then make her an offer of some decent accommodation for her and the family. Well, they did rehouse her in Spitalfields, but she never ever accepted an offer when it was sent to her, although she had a number, because she was where she wanted to be. And the offers she was sent were nice properties, but nice properties in an area that she didn't want to go. And so she'd achieved her aim, or at least the racists who had bricked her windows achieved it for her.
We didn't set out with a plan. Things just happened. One thing led to another. And my attitude was, if you say to people, you have a meeting of homeless Bangladeshis or homeless whites, because you know there were a lot of white squatters, if you say to them, come on, we're going to take over this block of flats, you can't then walk away and leave them. You have a responsibility. You've got them into this situation. You've got to stay with it and see it out to the end, which is what we did.
Terry Fitzpatrick would become a thorn in the side of Reg Beer and others at Tower Hamlets Council, with his ability to turn derelict or empty buildings awaiting redevelopment into decent squatted accommodation in places like Pelham Buildings.
Well, the first thing is we'd look to see if the services had been cut off. So we'd look at the pavement, look at the street. Then we might get a ladders and go in and go around testing the gas, water and electricity. I mean, there were properties where they'd all been cut off and the relevant authorities would not turn them on. So, you know, there were quite good properties where they just, you see them, LEB off on the road, gas off, water off. Once the services were on, I'd have a look as a builder at the structure of the building. Is it watertight? Yes. OK, we can go for this one. And then we would get the vans ready. We get the families, mattresses, cooking things. And then a squad of us would rip the tin off, boot the doors open. Or sometimes what I'd do is I'd open the doors from the inside, just leave the tin on the outside. And then myself or somebody else would be inside and we'd just boot the tin off. In come the kids, the mattresses, the cooking equipment. Someone would bring the cops and we're in, you know. All the tools would be gone, so there's no signs of a break-in. So they couldn't do you for, all they could do you for was criminal damage. You know, you've damaged a nail. People were taken to the magistrates used to throw it out. You know, you've damaged that GLC nail by pulling it out with your jemmy. And then we go from there. We try to do it over a weekend. Monday mornings, we'd be down to the council. We've occupied this, and in the end, the council's just they gave up. You know, there were too many. There were too many squatters. And what happened was, relations would arrive and they would then double and treble up with somebody in the squat. So the squats became overcrowded, you know, and there was no answer to it. I mean, there really wasn't.
By 1978, the Greater London Council, who owned most of these properties, would advocate setting aside entire estates for Bangladeshi families. When the national press ran the story, they talked of the ghettos plan.
In Whitechapel, the impact was enormous, so much so that when we were filming yesterday, a little white boy asked us if it were true that he and his family were to be moved out to make room for the Asians. But had the Asians themselves been consulted about this? It seems that it was a shock for them too.
We have never told them, empty a block of flats for us. We have never said that. What we have said is that we want to live in a safe area. Where this concept of a single ghetto estate has come from, I don't know. You would have to ask the press, who have been writing about it. You know, they have treated it as a sensational news item.
Before 1978, the lives and times of the newly emerging Bengali community were rarely covered by the national media. All this would change that summer as racial violence seemed to explode. But for Ken Leach, the warning signs had been there for years.
1976, I would say, onwards, was when the racial attacks increased from 68, and then particularly in the 70s. The National Front didn't have a particular presence in Bethnal Green Road until the mid-70s. They weren't there when I first arrived. At least I didn't see them.
From my point of view, and for a while, it was a good time. I felt that there was a possibility of the British people who are trusting, but not terribly politically sophisticated, could be roused and woken up, and that they weren't going to be trampled on, and they were going to rise up against those who were trampling on them.
Martin Webster, the National Front's national activities organiser, would soon find himself in nearby Shoreditch at their HQ, Excalibur House, where his duties included editing the party's newspaper.
National Front News. National Front News. Latest edition.
Up the English.
NF News, 10 pence.
Right-wing groups have always been very active on Sunday mornings, selling their publications at the corner of Brick Lane and Bethnal Green Road. From before the war, let alone after the war, and National Front newspaper sellers had been going there, well, virtually from when the party was formed in the late 1960s, and certainly come the mid-1970s, when we set up our broadsheet publication, National Front News, which was designed for selling on streets. It was just one A3 sheet, a simple, cheap paper, and people going to the street markets there on Sunday mornings, we found they were selling in huge quantities, and National Front branches from all over the East End used to go there on a Sunday morning, sell their papers, and then spend the lunchtime in the local boozers.
What's in the papers that you've been selling today?
Race. That's all it was. Race, the only basis for nationality. If you're white and British, then you can stay.
I'm not coy in telling you this. I wanted there to be an upsurge of British outrage against what had been done, because I did hope that our marches, our protests, our propaganda, standing in elections all over the place would create a confrontation with the establishment. If you're asking me if I've got any regrets, no, I'm sorry, I wasn't more efficient and effective in what I was trying to do.
Night time was very bad. Night, you'd not venture out of your house or your immediate territory, the two or three streets next to you, once it became dark. And even during the summertime, I don't think people would have gone out after 7 o'clock or something like that in the evening.
It was almost as if, from the point of view of outside of East London, it wasn't happening. And inside, it almost didn't seem to matter.
Just give out these leaflets. My mate printed some himself. He got me scared. He's got to come round. A group of 14 or 15 of us got to go around smashing windows and Pakistani's windows, burning the houses down, things like that.
The newspaper didn't report very much to start. The new arrivals weren't buying their papers. They were alien to the newspaper's normal readership. So they were being largely ignored.
Mike Jemson was then a reporter on the East London Advertiser, the traditional forum for local opinion, gossip and controversy. He found it increasingly difficult to place stories that revealed the day-to-day violence being encountered by the Bangladeshi community.
These were seen as grim stories which didn't enhance the life of the community, and a community that was quite depressed by the closure of the docks, by all sorts of other problems that were besetting the area. It was also seen, and there's a sad irony about this, that if we were reporting these sorts of attacks, we were giving prominence to a very tiny minority of the community, and that somehow was seen as a bit on the fringes of things. Getting to those stories was difficult because there was no proper link, and it was really only through sort of community action groups that began to try and use the press to tell the story that we got involved in reporting those sorts of incidents. But they'd been going on for a long time before we began reporting them.
Jemson was one of those contributing to the first major report documenting the scale of racist attacks then unfolding. Issued by the Bethnal Green and Stepney Trades Council in 1978, Blood on the Streets still makes disturbing reading, even now, for one of its authors, Dan Jones.
29th December 1976, a 15-year-old Bengali boy is attacked by a gang of four or five youths as he's walking down Aldgate High Street around 4 p.m. The boy was initially sworn at by the white youths, and he swore back. The youths then attacked the boy, knocking out one of his front teeth. They then ran off. The boy went to the London Hospital the following day for treatment. 6 days later, his teacher reported the incident at Bethnal Green Police Station. The station officer refused even to enter the incident in his record book, suggested it was often the Bengalis who started the fights.
I think one of the difficult things for me was that you began to think that things were getting out of hand because you knew about these things. You became almost a bore if you tried to talk about it all the time, and you certainly weren't going to get space in the newspapers for it.
12th of November 1977, 5:45 p.m, a 20-year-old Bengali youth is attacked and stabbed five times in the back by a gang of about 30 white youths while walking home to Brick Lane through Wentworth Street in Spitalfields. The youths pushed their victim against a wall, punched him, and then stole 15p in cash, a watch, keys, matches and cigarettes. Then the Bengali was stabbed and immediately lost consciousness. As the attack occurred during a power strike, the wounded man was unable to recognise any of the attackers.
What I felt I needed to try and do was to get across the idea that this is a human situation and that these people who are under attack need support and sympathy. Now, actually out on the streets, whilst there was support and sympathy, there was also a lot of people who had no jobs, whose housing conditions were poor, and who were frankly quite angry about all these newcomers turning up. And apparently, the more attacks there were, the more politicians realised they were going to have to do something about it. And some of the local community felt that they were losing out as a result.
10th December 1977, 12:45 p.m, a Bengali couple and their 12-year-old daughter were attacked by several youths on a bridge between Watney Street and Watney Market, just where I live. Both parents were knocked to the ground, insulted and kicked. The wife was 5 months pregnant. There were many witnesses in the area, but nobody came to the aid of the victims. The young people ran off. The family managed to reach a bookshop nearby from where the police and ambulances were called. According to our informant, the police appeared to be indifferent to the attack, but asked if any member of the family was able to recognise the attackers. The 12-year-old daughter said she could. The mother was taken to the London Hospital for treatment and discharged 2 days later.
So it was almost like a sort of forgotten little war with lots of casualties, but no Brits involved.
The Brick Lane area of Bethnal Green, one of the worst slums of a decrepit inner city, headlined because of recent violent clashes between gangs of white and Asian youths. According to the Trades Council report, a place where Asian families live in a constant state of siege, afraid to go out of their homes. Caroline Adams, a local community worker who helped prepare the report, says the picture it shows is just the tip of the iceberg.
The 100 or so very serious cases that are listed in this report are only a small sample of some of the more serious things which have been happening. These are the ones which the Trades Council and the Bangladesh Youth Movement and other people have very carefully investigated. All the people have been interviewed and so on. But they're just examples of numbers of stabbings, of motiveless attacks, or apparently motiveless with no robbery, of many attacks on people in their homes, windows being broken, doors being set on fire, children being beaten up on their way in and out of the houses. The atmosphere for Bengali families in East London is one where violence is a constant factor. most of the assaults in this document weren't reported to the police. I think perhaps that says what the Bangladeshi community feels about the police.
The police in generally at that time was, to put it mildly, very slow to respond to any kind of racial incident, right? If we put it most mildly. But most generally, I think police were not terribly sympathetic to our cause.
I was attacked by a gang of about 20 and beaten up brutally. My nose was smashed. It was bleeding. Then after that, I was taken to the hospital.
Raja Nuddin says he complained to the police but was told there was nothing that could be done.
What do you do if you are called in by, say, an Asian family who's been having trouble?
Right, if they've had a brick through the window, their first course of action would be, can they identify the individuals or the individual responsible? If they do, I would get hold of the individual concerned and the person making the initial complaint, and I would say, would you like to tell me in front of this person exactly what happened? Now, provided we get to things logically and it's not too serious, then obviously we can solve it at a neighbourly level. I also feel that Asian problems are escalated a great deal simply because of the lack of the English knowledge of the English language, basically. It makes them withdrawn. They're reluctant to come forward. They're reluctant to communicate with the rest of the community simply because their knowledge of English is grossly inadequate. If we could resolve this problem, and I think inter-community relations would be far better than they are. I don't think that the Asians here have any more problems than most.
Most whites, you mean?
Yeah. It's not a racialist problem.
The people who made the complaints would end up being arrested. I mean, I attended incidents where people were very upset because excrement had been put through their doors or windows had been smashed or a place had been set on fire. And you'd have a large crowd of white local residents shouting and hollering. You'd have the police, and then you'd have a very frightened family right in the middle of this thing. And if there was any remonstration by people who'd been under attack, they would be the ones who got arrested. That meant there was no trust at all in the police.
There was a horrible incident. A poor old dosser was beaten to death in the bottom of a block of flats with a gas canister thing by two youths. And the police, on this particular occasion, found the miscreants and arrested them. And they spilled the beans, these boys, of not just that, what they'd done to that particular man and how that happened, but a whole series of maybe 100 and plus incidents they'd been involved in gay bashing, packy bashing, hitting on old drunks. I mean, with hammers and things like that, I mean, really violent actions. And very few of the Bengali attacks the police had any record of at all. And very interesting, because very often the community kept the incidents to themselves, held it in, didn't go to the police.
Do I condone it? Yes. They've got no right to be here.
That families should have bricks thrown through the window, air gun pellets, that kind of thing?
Well, only blacks, white and Jews, yeah. White European race, white is the superior race, and always will be.
Sunday after Sunday, white youths, encouraged by the atmosphere created by the National Front, went on the rampage, breaking shop windows and attacking passing Asians. The police couldn't prevent them.
How much were you associating this level of crime thuggery with the increase in activity of the National Front in the area?
It's very difficult to know. I made an association, we did, in our minds, of the style and language and so on of some of the skinheads was very much associated with sort of the politics of the extreme right on demonstrations and things like that. But to make direct connections, incident by incident, very hard to do.
They weren't conducted by National Front members, and they weren't organised by the National Front. And what you must also remember is that in addition to the National Front, which was a lawful political party, there are other political factions and groups in the area, groups like the British Movement, which were proscribed by the National Front, who didn't bother with electoral activity and who had their own way of expressing themselves. I would say they're, for the most part, stupid, ignorant boys engaging in acts of violence and vandalism the way ignorant teenage boys do all over the place.
The top end of the brigade by the traffic junction, National Front used to send the newspaper. So for them, that particular sport was very important on a Sunday. They're like spreading lies to people, passerby, giving free newspaper, selling newspaper, giving leaflet and things like this. So for them, it was a place that they wanted to occupy to threaten the people living in and around Brick Lane, because they have to pass through that particular field. So they, you see these thugs with their swastika and military combat uniform, right? It's very scary. You have to go cross the road and, you know, they are standing there. So they want to create this fear among the people, right? It is important to remove these people from that area.
Your chief is, I want to talk to him because the National Front do not sell in this corner.
He's coming in now, sir. He's coming in.
Well, we'll see when
you're
he comes.
Breaking your agreement, you see.
Because if
I'm
you
not breaking anything.
But whatever, whoever is your in charge.
I've told you once, it's a case of first come, first served.
First came, first served.
Yeah.
It means they can occupy all of the place.
We have been in this corner first, and the police have been very quick to tell us that the National Front must have a corner. But when they get here, first you give the whole thing. This is the impartiality of the police, right?
Mark, piss off. On your way.
On your way.
On your way.
Go
on.
On your way.
On your way. On your way.
I'm not talking,
impartiality
talking to
the police. You are on the side of the National Front, right?
The police refused to do anything about the National Front. They said they're breaking no laws. And there was a public meeting at the Montefiore Centre. There were about 500 or 600 people came to protest about the National Front presence in Bethnal Green Road. And there was a police officer there in charge of community relations. And rather unwisely, he said in the hearing of these 600 people, there's no way we can remove them. All I can suggest is that if anti-racists disapprove of their presence, they should turn up first.
Our people used to get along there 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. The left would come along and grab the pitch at 7 or 8 in the morning, and it got to the stage where one of our members had turned up at 4 o'clock in the morning to grab his favourite pitch to sell National Front newspapers.
It started with about 50 people, and it grew to, when the Bengalis joined in, it grew to about 4,000.
Tit for tat, ding dong struggles between street activists for the National Front and street activists for the Socialist Workers' Party.
About 10, 11 o'clock, people will start gathering, and in their 100, they will sit down there.
We used to have vigils at Brick Lane every weekend.
Cathy Forrester was one of the locals who'd regularly attend the vigil.
You know the Nazril, the restaurant? Mm. That used to be open for us to go in there and have a cup of tea and all that all through the night. We were strong because there was loads of people there, and we were peaceful all throughout the night, right until the following morning.
It was a collective effort. This is my home.
Nuruddin Ahmed.
And I should be able to work freely without being scared by anybody.
An injunction was obtained from the commissioner saying that nobody could be on that site. So from saying there's nothing we can do about them, they're not committing any offence, the moment anti-fascists non-violently occupied the site, we were told that we couldn't be there.
The attempts to stop the selling of far-right literature at the top of Brick Lane would continue for more than a decade after these first vigils, leading to increasingly heated confrontations between the far-right and groups such as the Anti-Nazi League. At one point, Brick Lane was labelled the most policed street in Europe, but many of the Asian youth groups had already come to feel that self-defence was a necessity.
The Bangladeshi Youth Front holds kung fu and karate self-defence classes twice a week. 80 of its 500 members have attended them at some time. 20 of them advance down the room, flicking their legs Bruce Lee fashion high in the air. The leader of the front, Rafiq Ullah, says firmly that it's not a vigilante group, that people must work with the police to protect themselves. Nevertheless, large numbers of his members could be mustered if needed at short notice.
This is not the nice word I'm going to say that, because there is no police can't protect you 24 hours. So obviously, sometime you need to defend yourself and you have to make your own decision. Once you make your own decision, I think they'll be scared. If I'm not safe, none of my family will be safe. None of my community will be safe. So I have to fight
What had happened is the racial attacks would be... It'd be over in seconds. You know, people jump out of the car, bash them over the bottle, and the car, gone. We were saying, you've got to defend yourself. So then we started organising the vigilante groups, patrolling, and we were involved in attacks on known racists. You know, it was, if you want to bash us, we'll bash you.
And vigilante groups, how would you recruit for those? Where would they be?
Word of mouth. They were just people we knew. He was one. They were the sensible ones, and we'd get in a car or a van, and we'd go and have a patrol around areas where we knew they were likely to be. It was the mere fact that the community knew, and the police knew, and the fascists knew, that the community was mobilising, even if we weren't as effective as we might have been, because we had no mobile phones. Somebody went off in a van for 2 hours, you didn't know where they were. But it was the fact that the community was getting itself organised and was organising to defend itself.
We are having a meal in Brick Lane. We have done our job, we had meetings, street meeting and so on, and suddenly somebody came and said that we have been attacked.
Oleke Bishwash, then a Hackney social worker, was increasingly drawn to the communal struggle unfolding in Brick Lane.
And I looked right, and then the brewery, under the bridge, you can see 250 young people, all white. They were marching right through Brick Lane. And we had no other option to shout and say, we will defend Brick Lane. So young people came out, and that was a pitch battle. I mean, we had the milk bottle hand to hand. We stopped them there. And then and only then police came, beat us up. Police threw me on the bonnet of a car and say, oh, sick and tired of it. I said, officer, what are you talking about? We have been attacked. It is our home. We have not gone anywhere to attack.
What was your position on self-defence?
I thought it was essential. The only thing that happened then was that the racist attacks moved further east, where the Bengali community either didn't exist or was very small. So I think the size of the community and the coming to consciousness of the community.
You knew that it was all very unsettled, shaky, thundery, but you also knew by referring back to history, the day referring back to the Battle of Cable Street, that you will win, because at the end of the day, the violent races were in the minority in the community. And the fact that we had decided that we are going to fight back, defeat the racists and fight for our rights and entitlements meant that mentally we were ready to fight for our existence.
The Bengali community had come of age and could no longer be treated as helpless victims.
On April the 30th, 1978, some 80,000 people gathered in Hackney's Victoria Park to watch the first major Rock Against Racism concert. Just 4 days after The Clash, the Tom Robinson Band, Steel Pulse and others gave anti-fascism a soundtrack, news came of the murder of a 24-year-old Bengali clothing worker, Altab Ali.
God forgive me, but, you know, Altab Ali's killing wasn't kind of a shock. It was, like, inevitable.
At that time, the National Front stood as candidates in every single ward in Tower Hamlets, 40-plus candidates. On election night, with high tension, Altab Ali was walking home through what was then called St Mary's Churchyard, Itchy Park, everybody called it. That evening, he was set upon by three young people and stabbed in the neck and killed.
Did you know Altab Ali?
I know him. Personally, I know him. So
tell me about Altab Ali.
Well, he was another young... He's, I think, 1 or 2 years older than me. And on that time, you find, even though this age gave, but still your friend, you know. You know, he was working in the rag trade in Henwood Street. And in the weekend, we met disco and things like this. And even in the cafe, we met. And he was a nice person, nice person.
At the time Altab Ali was killed, then everybody says, we had enough. Now we need to do something about it.
It was just spontaneous because every individual felt either threatened or they felt they are not being valued. So it was just a collective response and spontaneous response. So
1,000 people, something like that. It was amazing. Almost all Asians, local Bengalis, Sikh people, but lots of other people as well. And we started off with these placards of the anti-Nazi league, and then the heavens opened. And so we had thousands of sticks with cardboard placards. The heavens opened and all the placards were washed off. So there were 7,000 people with sticks in the park. And I said, I had collected up all the sticks. Latty, Latty, Donovan, thank you very much. Give me your sticks. So we didn't go as an armed group with sticks. And it was a very moving demonstration with slogans in English and Bengali, as I remember.
It was a silent march. The only people who made a noise were the white left, who started chanting the usual slogans, but they went quiet because the old Bengali men looked at them with disapproval and said, you can come with us, but this is a silent... I don't think they called it a march, actually. I think they said this is a silent procession. I think it was a turning point.
Then, on July the 17th, 8,000 Asian workers in East London came out on a one-day strike. Most shops and businesses were closed in protest at what had been happening.
The people got back their confidence. They felt as if they can rely on themselves. They can defend themselves. Because they tried in the past all the conventional means, writing to the MPs and this and that, but now they feel as if they can defend themselves. It is an affair of the whole East End, Hackney, Dow Hamlet and Newham. It is a struggle for all people of East End. It's no longer confined in or Brick Lane alone.
Following the murder of Altab Ali, there grew a resistance movement. The slogan was, here to stay, here to fight.
Archive on 4, Hate Against Hope, was presented by Alan Dean and produced by Mark Berman.
Documents question our view of the past, to look back at events that we thought we understood, and now we find perhaps we didn't. Things weren't quite what they seemed.
The award-winning Document returns to BBC Radio 4.
It's not only the past, it's also the way the past affects the future. We will look at a particular incident and say, well, if that happened then, which is something we didn't know, how has that affected the world today?
A new view of history with Mike Thompson in Document, starting on Monday night at 8:00.